Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, April 9, 2009, and this is Doug Kelly, your host. I'm here with Grant Rippendunst.
Hey, everybody, welcome. Happy Thursday night.
And tonight we have Scott Marlowe with us from Pangea Institute. We're happy to have him back. A couple of housekeeping notes before we get into the meat of the program. Just want everybody on the Field Investigator program. We're slated to release that now to open it up here in the next few days. We're just almost done with the Paranexus Registry, which is what we've been writing, a brand new database to store anomalous reports and data and so forth, and we've been writing that from the ground up. Mike Jones taking a lead on that. And so we've almost got first deployment, and once that's ready, we're going to start taking applications for field investigators, so we'll announce that in the newsletter just as soon as it's available. We're excited about that. Also wanted to mention, for those of you who live in Florida, we are having our first Paranexus Monthly Forum in near Parrish, Florida, just south of Tampa at the Retreat Ranch, and there is information about that on paranexus.org. So if you live in the area, we invite you to come and join us. We're going to be talking about psychic development a little bit. We're also going to discuss evidence review, and Gregory Kent's going to do a table tipping demonstration at the end of it. So it'll be a great time to network and meet new people and learn some new. We're going to be doing this on the second Saturday of each month, and we're going to try to bring some speakers in and basically make it a learning and networking experience. So hope to see you there. The gates open at 4. The forum itself begins at 6. It'll run a couple of hours, and then we'll do the demonstration. So it's a beautiful area, and we do have some pictures on the site. So go to paranexus.org. You'll see it right there at the top.
If you're close, Scott, by all means, come and join us because it's a beautiful retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when is this going to be?
That's this Saturday. Hey,
it's
Scott,
Saturday.
Might as well introduce you. Scott Marlowe, come on down.
Welcome, Scott.
Well, thank you, Bob Barker.
Yeah.
Door number one.
In fact, I just got thinking Scott would
now,
be.
Now, I always get messed up if I pick door number one. I want door number two.
You got it, man. Yeah, it'd be great to have you sometime, Scott. Come and do a presentation on cryptozoology. I wasn't going to put you on the spot on the air, but I got thinking, hey, you know, that's Scott.
Well, you know, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And all you got to do is give me a date and time. If there's no scheduling conflicts, fine. You know where I'm going to be on the 18th. So it would be a good weekend if I could sneak away. I'll have to see if I can clear my thing and get back with you.
This is on the 11th. So this is this Saturday. And then next month, on the second Saturday of the month, whatever that is, and I'll talk to you about that, because if we can get you on that one,
I know next month is shot. I've got a group coming in from Paris, France, an expedition. And immediately after that, I have to go out to Texas on an expedition. So.
Well, we're going to talk all about that stuff. So. But if you're free Saturday and you want to come and join us, it's a beautiful area and a beautiful time. So that having been said, we've got Scott Marlowe with us. We're going to talk about a number of different things centered around cryptozoology. And you kind of whetted our appetite. So, Scott, since you were on last, which was last right around Halloween, why don't you update us on what's new?
Oh, well, we've had some very interesting developments. You know, 7 years ago, I was diagnosed with cataracts, and I got away with ignoring them until January. And at that point, I had so many television show appearances scheduled, I couldn't afford to go in and have the surgery done. And you know, we can talk a little bit about all the different shows and all of that. But I didn't finish taping the last one until the first part of March. And by the first of March, my eyesight was so bad, I think you could say I was legally blind. Now, there have been rumors circulating all over the internet, and I
greatly exaggerated. As
oh yeah, I feel like I feel like Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain. You know, the rumors of my blindness, impending departure from cryptozoology, have been vastly overstated.
Well,
I am doing neither. If anything, my visibility within the profession is going to increase exponentially. So please don't believe that nonsense. And you know, if you need a letter from the doctor, fine, I'll get you one. I got one for the college. So no, you know, it got everybody up in arms because they were all afraid I was holding back on something, and nothing of the kind. It's ridiculous. I don't know where this stuff comes from. But it just seems to take on a life of its own. It's sort of like that idiotic Miyaka skunk ape photo. I've been debunked as an orangutan. I can't tell you how many times. It's now the non-issue that just won't go away. And so you know what I'm getting at. I mean, it's like somebody's going to bring it up no matter where you go, no matter what you do. And it's ass in nine. But, I mean, I would really have to be in a bad way to get out of cryptozoology, and, that may happen when and if I'm on my deathbed, but not now.
Many, many, many years from now.
Hopefully, many, many years from now.
Yep.
I've got a lot of people out there, and Doug, I know you know this, who, maybe it was wishful thinking. On the other hand, some of my detractors, who shall remain nameless, would love this rumor to stick, but it's not true. And you are the first one that I have told this to on the air officially, including our own show. So
wow, we're fortunate here.
So stop the practice.
My unveiling and coming out party and all of that stuff will be up at Ripley's on the 18th. So everybody come and see me and see for yourself. Throw your hands in front of my face, rub it up and down. Yes, I'll see you. And if you put it too close to my mouth, I may bite you. In any case, it's definitely not true.
Mm-hmm. All right, So you've been pretty being busy, it sounds like, from the emails I've been getting.
I'm so far behind the eight able to read for almost three months that I'm playing the Russian catch up game, and I'm getting there, and everything is in an order of importance and priority, largely due to how much money it pays, especially now that I got to pay for the operation. So. There you are. But in any case, no, I've been extremely busy with the guys at White Wolf working on a couple of episodes for them. And, of course, I've been in front of the camera as well as camera doing research. So, I can talk a little bit about some of the things that have been going on. But under my contracts with these guys, I can't spill the beans until the episodes are going to air and I get the green light from everybody. But I did one episode of coming up. That was the first. That was the one you actually came and tried to work with us as an extra on, Doug, which didn't exactly work that way. That I think that episode has been cursed from day one. We can't talk specifically about what it deals with, but it does have to do with a water beast. That much I can tell already on the internet. I can't talk about specifics. But in any event, it's supposed to air now April 22nd. It was supposed to have aired yesterday, but in their inimitable wisdom, History Channel decided they're going to play reruns during spring break. So we got preempted for two more weeks, and it's going to air on the 22nd now. But the associate producer, Rose Dunn, who did a really fine job putting it all together, got back up to North Dakota and promptly broke her ankle and went into the hospital, which delayed. And I'm sure everybody has been following all of these floods going on up that way. That and then, I think it's Minnesota and all that too, where the White Wolf has their studios. And Rose happens to live on River Road.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, while her house has had a couple of inches in the basement, been inundated, and, it's like up to the first floor, and, they've been battling rising water with sandbags and all that lovely stuff, and she's had to evacuate with the kids. So, believe me, this thing couldn't get any worse.
Jeez.
I mean, they have really, and they've been troopers through the whole thing. They've been really, really professional, and working with Will and Rose and Doug and Joe and the whole has just been a great privilege. And of course, Dr. Patook, who's one of our Pangea fellows, is in this with me, being an expert on this type of thing. And it was really fun doing it, but it's like we're all on pins and needles waiting to see what the final product looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really cool because in this particular instance, the cryptid, in quotes, may very well be an extinct animal. And, I think I have identified what it is. And further research is going to show that it's thing or it's something that Dr. Patook is suggesting rather than, an animal that is not yet known, which could be, but not very likely.
So do you talk about that on the episode, Scott?
Yes. Oh, yeah. They interview us in depth about, and again, I don't know how it's all going to cut. Most of it's probably on the cutting room floor. But, we do talk a lot, and the great footage of the animal. And for someone who's not really familiar with, water beasts down here, you could easily get confused. This is going to be a fun show to watch, and I don't want to spill the beans because I'm not one of those tellers and that spoil the movie before it shows. Sure.
And where was it filmed? Can you say that, right?
Yeah, it was filmed in the Palm Beaches.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So, this is really intriguing because this thing is personal.
Yeah. We'll see what happens with it. It'll be interesting.
Yeah, it certainly
will. Even though I'm not in it.
We wish that it worked out differently. And unfortunately, all the extras that showed up didn't get used, which really annoys me. And then I was told with another episode not to bring any extras, and we wound up needing them. So this is a different episode that I still don't know where that is.
I'm going to build Monster Quest for $120. I rented tanks and everything. I was ready to
get traps and everything, too.
Oh, my God, that really sucks.
Yeah.
But, I that goes along with this reality show thing where they want everything spontaneous and they really don't know what they want until they get there. Unlike my film projects, which fortunately I get a script, so I know what I'm doing. But, it gets kind of hairy. I really, I got to respect people who just film and film and film and film and film and just watch this stuff over and over and over again in the editing. And eventually see a story and pull it together out of all of the material because it's just it's hours and hours of material, so it's really interesting.
Yeah, I got to edit it down to 40 something minutes.
Probably 20 minutes by the time all the commercials and everything.
Well, with the commercials and all that, probably they could probably come up with like 36 or 37 minutes of episode, and make it exciting too. Which is sometimes not that easy, because in most cases, as the cryptid is a no-show. So,
right.
So it's just not so simple to make these things look good, and it's quite a job. And I'm working with them on another one I can't talk about, but right now doing some background research, and we're still torn between whether we're going to wind up in California or Florida doing the filming, even though we know what the subject matter is. And so it's really, there's big difficulties. And, of course, I was involved in another one that deals with an animal down in the South Pacific that they finished filming and they're getting ready to do. And the logistics of just pulling that thing together was a nightmare for the AP associate producer that did that one. And I understand after all is said and done that people wound up in the wrong place. And when you talk about the wrong place, instead of being in PNG, Papua New Guinea, they wound up in Singapore and they couldn't get the right place. I mean, well, that because we had that problem here in South Florida.
Yeah, really.
So, I mean, and then, of course, you've got to add the layer of you have to have permission to film, and that was a mess, and you've got to have shots, and you know, people have got to do things within a period of time, and you wind up feeling like a pincushion and sick as a dog because you get all the shots all at one time in order to meet the deadlines. It's not easy. It really, doing these things is not easy, and people think it's a piece of cake.
Yeah.
It is not. It is very, very complicated.
Mm-hmm. So what's going on in the world of cryptozoology lately?
Well, the big talk now, and let's start with zoology. The big talk now has been some of these escaped animals, which are cropping up all over the place. I guess the most, the biggest story right now is the chimp that got loose in New Haven, Connecticut, and wound up nearly ripping a woman's face off.
Oh yeah.
And of course, it's in the last couple of years, it's been there's at least one chimp attack, that you got to deal with, even in the facilities that care for them and know what they're doing, and most of them, I'm sure you remember the tiger attack a couple of years back in Palm Beach, where the tiger was really a very tame animal, but as with any wild animal, if you corner it and threaten it and don't give it a way to escape, you wind up creating a confrontation, and the animal inevitably loses, especially, and don't get me wrong, I've got lots of respect for the boys in blue, but when we start playing the heat big white hunter, and you're deliberately trying to provoke an animal until you've got an excuse to kill it, I draw the line.
Yeah.
I'd rather shoot the cop. I said it on the air, but that's true of everybody. I mean, don't take me literally, folks. I'm not a rap star. That stuff bothers me. If you want to control an animal like that, you do not have a corner. You fence off its options so it goes where you want it to. 9 times out of 10, they'll behave in a logical way, and they'll choose retreat over the fight reflex if they get a chance. But this speaks to one thing that I'm really passionate about, and that's idiots, and I mean it. Idiots that keep wild animals as pets.
I agree.
Yeah, I couldn't think of a better pet than a 200-pound chimp that's 8 times stronger than a man in your home.
Yes, and we're going to treat it like it's
and you. Sedated on Xanax.
Put it on the diaper and talk to it like it's a little baby, and play postpartum depression with it. I'm sorry, but the woman needs to be not incarcerated. She needs to be institutionalized. I'd rather see her in a cage than a chimp.
I'm not sure what you're really trying to say here. Could you be?
Oh, I wasn't plain enough. Watch the ratings climb here, Doug. I mean, I'm really making enemies tonight. I'm going to get more hate mail than Gandhi.
Yeah, brother. Yeah, you're
go for it.
Peaceful coexistence with wild animals. Let them be wild.
Yeah.
Stop trying to
imagine that.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Let them be wild.
Yeah. Let my animals go.
Oh, God.
Let's have a mass exodus.
Moses there,
Yeah, just give me the staff.
Yeah. Stand him in front of some body of water or something.
The bad part about that is, and I know that you're with it, Scott, is the fact that these people will get these animals when they're young, and whether they're the cats or chimps or whatever, they get them when they're young, and then they find out that they really are a handful, and then they end up in these god-awful animal retreats someplace where, some of them are good and some aren't. There's one, fortunately, around Sarasota, I think we've got one that's halfway decent, but we've got animals that, there's nowhere else for them to go.
You've got a couple of them that are really decent and are better than them being in a bad situation, if you know what I'm saying, but the wild is the place for them. Leave them there. From chimps, and I imagine Dr. Jane would bear me out here. I hope she'd bear me out, but the bottom line with the chimps is cute and cuddly till they get to be about 5. And that's kind of sort of like when, the hormones start to rage.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you've got an alpha male or an alpha female, that can be a real headache. But even with the ones that aren't, the alpha types, they become highly unpredictable. And, you know, imagine spending, you know, the rest of your life with a human teenage on steroids taking speed.
Well, that would be a pleasant experience.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you know, just completely off the wall, and it's even worse because they're like enormously strong, about 5 to 7 times
a
human being. So, you know, if you are deluded enough to think you can control them in every situation, you are really, really fooling yourself.
But, you know, I think that's the epitome of your argument there, you know. There's a chimp, a thinking, cognitive creature, who's 8 times stronger than we are, and, you know, and I think that, you know, like any type of creature, it wants to be free. And, you know, when this case with this lady that was attacked by that chimp, there's been other cases where they've been behind bars. Zookeepers have their fingers just chewed off. By chimps, where they just grab them out of the blue because they want to be free. They're in a cage. They're pissed off. They're going to get back at anybody. You know, they're their jailers. They're not, you know, they're mm-hmm. the friendly zookeeper. And the injuries they can inflict on a human being are horrendous.
Well, and to be fair to the chimps, it's not really any more in terms of numbers. I don't think I'd have to look at the stats. But I really, you know, as a guy who handles wildlife, don't think that the numbers are, you know, in any particular animal's, you know, favor, if you will, towards attacks. I think they all do it just about, you know, you got to understand the animal you're dealing with. And it's not a cute and cuddly little thing. And no matter how much they look, they can bite, they can inflict serious injury, as they have done. I mean, we have an animal handler trainer out in California lost half his face to a chimp attack in all of about 4 seconds.
Well, you know, the question that begs to be asked, Scott, and you're going to bear with me because I'm not really jumping track that far, but the question that begs to be asked is when people have bumped into Sasquatch, you know, that doesn't seem to have that same disposition. Have there ever been any really documented cases of people being attacked and harmed, physically harmed?
Well, I don't know about documented in the sense that, you know, you're talking about a formal documentation. But there are some interesting stories. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, our president, wrote mm-hmm. about two trappers, you know, I believe it was up in the Rockies, where, you know, they encountered, you know, a Sasquatch and shot at it, apparently wounded it. And the animal hung around watching and waiting, according to, you know, Teddy's story, until one of them was left alone and then promptly, you know, marauded into camp and killed one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the other one left very hastily.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I very rarely ever hear stories where, you know, Bigfoot or Sasquatch, whatever you want to call it, or Almasty, depending on where in the world, because you do realize there's more than one kind of Bigfoot.
Absolutely.
All right. You know, that unless we attack them first, where they have attacked us, you know, on a whim, which leads me to think that they're not what people think. But in any event, you know, there's also a story about a Russian farmer who had an Almasty, you know, come into their home, you know, apparently killing livestock and stuff, which they will do. And mm-hmm. You know, they eventually something occurred where the animal was again shot, or an attack ensued where the animal was hurt, and or its mate was killed. I forget the precise story. I'd have to look it up for you, but it's something along those lines. And the farmer's wife and son were killed by the animal with a bite to the neck, which coincidentally is how chimps kill, which is, you know, I find interesting. They bite to the neck. You know, when we do violence to them, they return violence to us.
But no unprovoked attacks.
I'm not aware of any. I'm sure it's happened where an animal felt threatened, or somebody wandered into a, you know, family group, or a situation where it felt its young were, you know, were threatened, or something along those lines. But I don't buy the, you know, the National Enquirer. I was abducted by Bigfoot and held as a sex slave for 2 weeks, and then I just walked away. You know, I doubt that.
But would be the similarities, Scott, between the behaviors of the mountain gorilla in terms of what we would see if you wandered in? You know, this is your area of expertise. If you wandered in, to an area that was inhabited by silverbacks or mountain gorillas, they would give you all kinds of warnings to back off at first, and if you, this is my basic understood, puff up and, you know, give all kinds of warning signs. But do they ever attack? They will attack too, won't they?
Well, let's put it this way: in all probability, you wouldn't see them.
Uh-huh.
They wouldn't let you. They wouldn't let you. They'll know you're there.
You'd never get that close.
Before, you know, and it's like swimming with a shark. The shark knows you're there, but you don't know the shark's there until it's, you know, until it's there bumping you and deciding, which is basically tasting whether you're gonna, you know, taste good.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
If you happened upon a group unexpectedly, they would probably charge you in an attempt to frighten you off. However, if you run, you're in trouble. You need to kind of stand your ground there and back up very, very slowly. Do not make eye contact with the leaders. That's taken by almost every predator as a threat or a challenge. You just don't do that. You've got to act subordinated. If they are acclimated to you, then they may actually interact with you, but not necessarily violently. As a rule, gorillas are vegetarians, and as vegans, they don't. They do take in some insect protein and stuff, but they're, you know, as a vegan, they consider humans prey. So you're not in that kind of a situation. So they tend not to be particularly violent per se, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't rip you apart if they wanted to.
But, and the same would run true with Bigfoot. And I'm just wondering. If you know, based on that, those kind of behaviors, if rather intellectually evolved, Bigfoot would be above a mountain gorilla.
Well, and again, it probably is considerably more intellectual than the mountain gorilla. But until we get a body and we can measure capacities, et cetera, we really don't know. I personally, as you know, don't think it's an undiscovered species. I think we know it is, and we do have evidence in the fossil record, and that some of the reports, particularly here in North America, are some sort of either relic hominin or, as M.K. Davis tried to point out, a human that has had very limited contacts, or should I say humans that have had very limited contacts because they were run off years and years and years ago because they were afflicted with a condition of trichosis and they simply don't mix with us. That's probably in some cases the answer to the riddle. Now, other things like the swamp ape, I think I know what those origins are. I hope I'm right. I'm not sure. Everything having to do with that animal until we actually find one is conjecture. Some of it is educated guessing, but and that's based upon what we know about other primates.
Well, what do you think it is?
Well, I think that the swamp ape is descended from a line of apes that's fairly obscure that a lot of people don't know about called the Deeropithecus.
Hmm. What about Gigantopithecus? Do you think that?
I don't buy it for a moment. I know Dr. Bellinger, associated with us, thinks otherwise, but I don't buy it.
Thank you.
That is not
okay,
blog
folks.
Talk. Hey.
Yeah,
I guess we're back.
Yeah, we lost blog talk connection there for a minute, so.
Doug's been playing with a Ouija board again. Everybody knows.
We love your blog talk.
That's right.
Yeah, we should
Pretty
be back.
Pretty soon his head's going to spin around and he'll be spurting ectoplasm everywhere.
Oh, God.
All right, so if you in the
All
chat.
Right, where were we before we were so crudely interrupted?
We were talking about Gigantopithecus.
Okay, yeah.
How you don't buy into that. But maybe for the benefit of our audience, because I think I know the species you were referring to. Can we just back up and could you just review again what you think Bigfoot is?
I think it's more likely a relic hominin. In other words, a primitive human.
Mm-hmm.
The Gigantopithecus is intriguing, but we don't really know enough about it. I mean, just about everything that is presumed, underlined, about the animal is presumed from part of a mandible and a couple of teeth. That's all we've ever uncovered on that animal. Everything else has been extrapolated from that based on what we know of known animals. Nature has a way of always doing things a little differently than we expect. So that's an issue. Now, that said, if those reconstructions are correct, which we have to presume they are, the animal would have appeared a great deal like a gorilla. Not exactly the same, but very similar to a gorilla. And therefore, the chest cavity would be rather large, and the hips would be of such a design that it would be very difficult for that animal to stand erect for any length of time, and would be a habitual knuckle walker, as the gorillas are, as opposed to a almost entirely bipedal animal. And that is partially due to the physiology, because with the chest bulging out like they do, et cetera, and the organs putting all that weight there, it forces the animal to lean over, as a result would tend to be a knuckle walker.
Here's a question from the chat room. Scott, by primitive human, do you mean missing a link?
Oh, God, please don't use that term. I don't know what that means, to tell you the truth. Missing link.
Well, think about what archaeology uses. You know, they talk about missing link and the evolutionary process. And
Do I think that all human species that have ever walked the planet have been discovered and are represented in the fossil record now? No. Do I think that we will find additional, niches in which there's been a nice little transition, which forces us, as we are continually doing, to rearrange the taxonomy so that, because we really don't know. We presume that we know where we fall on the family tree, but there may have been transitional species, and in that respect, a missing link. Well, yeah, okay, fine. Those things are being uncovered all the time, and we learn. And every time we learn something new, we shuffle the family tree around a little more. Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
Cool.
So, Scott, where in the fossil record, are there any indications that the hominid that you think may be Bigfoot? Is there anything in the fossil records that indicates they've lived together in communities, or they've been what does the fossil record tell us, I guess? That's a simple question.
Well, at one time, there were more than one, and as many as I think four or five now, human-type species living at the same time. Now, nature does its wonderful thing, and species die out or become extremely rare or what have you. Different kinds of things happen. But as a rule, although it is not impossible, and certainly there are examples that that contradict what I'm about to say, as a rule, there is rarely one species of a particular genus. But again, that's not always the case. There are examples that defy that. And of course, right now we presume that that is the case with humans, but it is not necessarily so. I think the mere fact that the hobbit, lived up until about 10,000 years ago, the end of the Ice Age, speaks very well to the possibility that there are other human species out there that may have in some way survived in niches around the world that for example, the mastiffs in the Himalayas that people haven't been to ever or don't go to very frequently. We're always finding these lost worlds, where other new animal species are turning up, et cetera, et cetera. It's not impossible for something to be there that we're not aware of. And again, if they survive without our level of technology and they have our experience, or should I say, our intelligence, it explains a great deal.
It
about
does.
How well they can avoid us. And certainly, I think human history shows that any interaction with a human is not a good thing. they probably have learned that, and I'm sure they have remembered it, and I'm sure they've got some way of passing it on. They've got no reason to have anything to do with us.
We were talking earlier about the attacks, and one thing that didn't come up is the rock throwing and other things. I mean, you yourself have experienced that.
Well, that's all well-documented primate behavior. You know, orangs are well known for, you know, grabbing chunks of wood and hurling it at people they don't want in their area. Of course, you don't know they're there, but they'll still throw it at you. You know, chimps throw things at people. Gorillas throw things at people. They, you know, they had an incident. Oh God, Disney World's going to kill me. But they had an incident at Disney World where, you know, a guest antagonized one of the gorillas at the gorilla exhibit, which, you know, promptly borrowed a little excrement and hurled it at the guest. I mean, those are behaviors that primates are well known for. Monkeys do that. So, you know, I have not heard anything in regards to throwing things, not wood knocks, things like that, that cannot be explained by a primate.
Right.
Or as a primate behavior, more specifically put.
Grant, you had something.
Yeah, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here, Scott. Some Bigfoot or Sasquatch have been described as being pretty tall, 8, 10, 12 feet, some accounts. What would be the evolutionary advantage?
Well, it depends. You know, sometimes being able to see over obstacles would make that an advantage, so that you're able to detect predators or some type of a threatening animal at a greater distance. You know, being able to pick fruits or berries or nuts or whatever that would be
bring down an elk or a moose.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
But, you know, and if people say, well, we don't know too many humans that were this big. Most humans were really smaller than that. Yeah. Not true. In the area of the Homo erectus, there was the Meganthropus subspecies, which actually was about 10 to 12 feet tall.
Really?
Yes.
Where were they found as far as on the globe? Were they found in any particular Asia?
The fossil records at this point put them in Asia, but it's evident that Homo erectus got around the world very efficiently. Mm-hmm. So there's more and more evidence that they were even here in North and South America.
So how long would you say that line, you know, carried on before it became extinct?
Well, I'd have to look at my notes to be sure, but I'm sure.
It's about a ballpark figure.
I think it was around at least 1.5 million years. I might be wrong.
Wow.
But you know, they've been around a while. And, I mean, that's one of the things that intrigues me about Deeropithecus is some of the anthropologists who have been working with the skeletons of these things, because they've been found, actually, the more current version, the Oreopithecus, which coincidentally around the Mediterranean, in the local languages, is called a swamp ape. They've checked the hips and what have you, and apparently Alistair Hardy's and Elaine Morgan's theory about the aquatic ape hypothesis for why, you know, bipedalism developed, yada, 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 seems to have applied to these animals, because in the swampy environments that they lived in, near the waters, they developed bipedalism 4.5 million years before Lucy, which is our nearest bipedal relative. So, you know, they've been walking a much longer time than we were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting stuff.
Well, it's really fascinating, you know, and it's always a delight to have it on the show, Scott, because I don't think a lot of people are aware of physical anthropology and all the changes that mankind's been through, and that, you know, most people just think we just popped out one day and we were from this real short line and, you know, we became the top dog, and it's much more complex than that.
Oh, yeah, it's extremely complex.
As you point out.
Well, and Dr. Goodall's work has changed our view as to what it is to be human, and, you know, what traits are human traits, if you will, definitive human traits. We know that chimps use tools now. We know that they can learn language and have symbolic language representation and can understand that. There's been experiments with chimps that and bonobos, which are a separate species but closely related, that they can, use computer keyboards and things like that to tap out messages using signs and symbols, like Coco the gorilla, who's learned American Sign Language. I mean, you know, the evidence just mounts. In my view, and this kind of becomes sort of metaphysical, which may fit you all, to me, the definition of a human is an animal that can aspire to be more than it is.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Most of these animals don't want to be more than they are, and it's not built into their wiring. So, overcoming your instinctive responses is part and parcel of what I think it is to be human.
Well, I would agree.
But, you know, and getting off the, you know, the metaphysical train, so, I mean, the line between, you know, the higher apes, the great apes and humans in demonstrable terms of culture, of tool use, et cetera, so it begins to blur. And that's an intriguing thing. You know, why
because we don't know what they, just because they can't articulate what their culture is doesn't mean they don't have one.
Exactly. And yeah, we know that the rudiments of culture are there because look at the chimps. In a particular area of Africa, they'll use a rock as a tool in order to open up a nut, you know, as their nutcracker. But in another area, in Africa, they'll use a chunk of wood. Now, the key issue that makes culture a thing here is the parents teach the young to do it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
That's culture.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're teaching, then there's something going on here. And, of course, down here in Sarasota, there's a facility that works with lower primates, which are lemurs and that type of thing. And they have done some experiments which show that even lemurs, which are much more primitive than the great apes in terms of their abilities, do have a cognition of what numbers are.
But that would make sense. Would make a lot of sense because you know they're arboreal. They have the stereoscopic vision so that they could feed themselves. You know, and that's going to come in very handy when you're picking fruit, especially when you're 100 feet up above the ground.
Well, in this case we're talking about there's six oranges on a table. Through a hole in the bottom of the table, you cover them all up, and you reach up under the table, you pull one out. It knows that one orange is missing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean that's for lower primates, that's pretty intelligent.
Yeah.
And of course I've worked with canids that have that kind of understanding too. But then they've been acclimatized to humans, so I can't say that in the wild it would be the same thing. I mean I had a bloody dog that could open doors and unlock them.
Mm-hmm.
I could put an Encyclopedia Britannica on the bloody toilet the cover and it'd still find a way to get in there. She was outrageously intelligent. And that brings us to other types of behaviors that can be easily misunderstood. Let's take Siegfried and Roy and the tiger attack. I don't for one minute believe that tiger attacked Roy.
Why?
Because of the way it attacked. Attack in quotes. They don't attack from the back like that. If they want to kill you, they attack from the front and grab you by the throat and cut off your larynx. They were grabbing him by the back of the neck as though he were a tiger cub, but of course we don't have the nap in the back of the neck that they can grab to pull their cub to safety. But they wouldn't know that. It saw something in the audience, whatever it is. I mean, I've heard people say some woman with a ridiculous hat and things like that. I don't know. I just know that the tiger was trying to save Roy from something it perceived as danger. Hmm. If it wanted to kill him, believe me, it would have killed him.
It would have done a long time before that. Yeah, you're right.
Well, here's a related question from Mike in the chat room. He says, Scott, I'm not sure where I read this, but is it true that they have a group of chimps that they taught to use rudimentary sign language and they are now teaching their young the same things?
I don't know for sure about the chimps. I would assume that it's so because the Coco experiments are so ancient now. Of course, she's never had an infant. She's never wanted to mate. I don't know if she's a lesbian gorilla or whatever, but she's never wanted to mate.
Let it out, Scott. You let it out now. Oh, damn. At least it was on our show.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. I mean, she had a mate. Yeah, she had a mate named Mike, and no matter how hard they tried, apparently, I mean, I don't know what that means, but she's never conceived. So, we don't know if she would have tried or would try to teach her child what she knows. And she's got a pretty significant vocabulary. I think it's like 3,000 words. I'd be absolutely flabbergasted if we hadn't conducted similar experiments by now with chimps. I have not read any of the reports. I've not read any reports about it, so I can't speak directly to the issue. But I do know that those experiments have been going on. but I don't know what the results are. And there may be a reason why that's been concealed. Now, you know, I can't even talk about this because I promised them I wouldn't, but there's similar types of things going on now, and again, involving numbers with dolphins. And there's some very surprising results. We've actually been down to a school where they're working with these animals, and I've actually watched it, and it's totally fascinating.
Well, the sad thing is, and I know you guys will agree with me, is the fact that we have this arrogance in regards to the creatures that nab this world with us, and we think that we're the top dog, and that no other creature is capable of intelligent thinking. I mean,
I'm going to drop a bomb.
We underestimate the abilities of everything around us a lot of times.
And I'm going to put that bomb right between the legs of all the skeptics out there.
Cool. I like that.
Okay. I have noticed over the years, and I've been doing this now 35 years, that the people who tend to do exactly what you're talking about are the skeptics who don't want to believe that something could be as good or as smart as humans are.
Mm-hmm. It's the arrogance, as Grant said.
It's anthropoid arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what it is.
And that's a trait of human beings, arrogance. We're all that. We've always been all that.
I can tell you that humans are not all that in a slice of bread.
Amen.
So I've seen things out in the woods that would flabbergast the average person. Maybe I've got a different perspective, and maybe I've got more respect for our animal neighbors, but, I emphasize the word neighbors,
right.
Because we share this planet with them. We are not, despite what the biblical record may have called us, we are not anything but their stewards. We are certainly not their superiors.
Related to that, Mike says, wouldn't the fact that other animals have the ability of cognizant ability attack religious beliefs?
That depends on whether they have them. The closest animal to us genetically is what?
I think it's a chimp, isn't it?
Yes, and now, thanks to very careful study over the last 20-some years, actually 30-some years, we know that they organize hunts. Do they do it
mm-hmm.
for territory? Do they do it for food? Do they do it for fun? Or all of the above? And who does that sound like?
Gee willikers. They have raiding war parties too, don't they? And they just go out and indiscriminately kill other tribes?
Yep, you got it. Now, nature probably has some reason for that we have not yet divined, but they're just as violent and just as nasty, or nearly so, as we are. Very sobering. And while you were on that sober subject, let's take this one. There has never been an invention that mankind has ever conceived that has not in some way, shape, or form, directly or indirectly, been used to kill another human.
To kill another human.
Mm-hmm.
Thought-provoking.
So, who's the superior animal, folks?
Yeah.
And we're talking about communicating with aliens from another solar system.
Why would they want to?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've
told Doug many times, it'd be like, walking out into your backyard and kicking over the biggest fire ant mound and saying, I'd like to talk to you guys now.
Well, assuming that you were as advanced as they must be to travel the millions and millions of miles or between dimensions that they do, and again, this assumes they exist.
Right.
And you were to come upon us and, look at us and our history, and certainly they've been around if you, believe all of the things that you read about and all the different historical documents, including the Bible, and you see all of this. It'd be like us walking up to Osama bin Laden and saying, hi there, want to make a deal?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no way you're going to win. So why would you want to?
Yep. But, the thing that I often wonder about, and I'm sure you guys have too, is, I think based on, and maybe this is arrogant too, But I think based on the type, the variation of life we see on this type of planet, that I think that there's going to be, I'm willing to go out on a limb and say that there's going to be similar evolutionary patterns on similar worlds with little differences. I mean, these you know, they're just going to lend it to itself.
Well,
under the right circumstances, and you would think that a hominid, that type of shape, if certain conditions are right, I mean, even on a planet that was had a heavier, you know, gravitational field, or a lighter gravitational field, it still may be advantageous to be a bipod as opposed to being, you know, walking on four limbs.
Well,
and again, advantageous for both.
You're right that the environment has a lot to do with how a species radiates into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and physical laws such as gravity and what have you would have an impact, of course. But assuming that you had a sister planet, which out of the billions upon billions upon billions of planets out there, I'm certain there is,
mm-hmm.
With nearly identical or identical gravity, nearly identical or identical environmental conditions, and you know that life began the same way, which apparently is a constant in the universe, and life being based on DNA developed the same way, and mutations would occur over time the same way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems that life would probably have paralleled us in development. Now, when you get into the massive environmental disasters such as cometary collisions and what have you, those things are essentially random chance. And on other locations, that may or may not have occurred, or something else entirely has occurred. But think about being on a planet, you know, God knows how far away, where life evolved along the same lines up until the point that we had dinosaurs and got down to the raptors, which were apparently quite intelligent. And the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs here didn't happen there. What would they look
mm-hmm.
like, and what would they be
mm-hmm.
able to do, given a 65-million-year jump on us?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some conjecture about that, you know, that the dinosaurs didn't all die out, that maybe they evolved and...
They did. We call them birds.
Right, but beyond that, I mean, there's conjecture, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, well look at how that. But that's a really good point, though, Scott. I mean, when I was a kid, and I'm going to be 60 years old in not too near future. When I was a kid, if somebody would have come to me and told me two things, I would have laughed in their face. Number one, if somebody had told me that, you know what, the moons of Jupiter or Saturn might have oceans and there'll be life underneath them, and the other one would be dinosaurs had feathers, I probably would have split my gut rolling around on the floor, because.
Yeah.
The idea of dinosaurs evolving into birds, for me personally, is very comforting because as a kid I loved learning about dinosaurs. And it just and when you look at some of the incredible fossils that they found in China with these dinosaurs with feathers, I mean, it's just like you may be very well right that they never did go away. They just evolved into a totally different creature.
Well, they're all around us.
With
me, it's been, you know, I've always had some feeling that there was something there, I mean, even when I was young, because I knew dinosaurs laid eggs, birds lay eggs.
Mm-hmm.
The only mammalian example that I know that I'm certain of, contrary to that, is the platypus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a more leathery type of egg. You know, the possibility, and of course the number of digits, et cetera, all lend itself to, gee, that's an interesting parallel. When I'm sitting there down to my Thanksgiving dinner, I'm thinking, I got to thank your relatives. It's just, they may have wanted to eat me, but look at how the tables have turned over in natural selection. Anyway, the bottom line is that the only constant in the universe is change.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's geared for that. And you know, we are not, and this is one of the reasons why this anthropoid arrogance drives me nuts. In a million years, we are not going to be what we are today.
Right.
No animal is. After about a million years of mutation is built up in the genetic makeup, it becomes a new species. There is enough mutation, therefore, to become a new species.
Hmm.
So that's going to happen to us, too. Whether we want it to or not. Unless, of course, we get involved in eugenics and natural selection and, you know, all those weird and, you know.
Scott, let me ask you a question. You know, as a person that, you know, that you obviously, you know, have a lot of respect for nature and, you know, you have an intense love for it.
Enough to be called a Gnostic.
Yeah, tree hugger. We'll call you a tree hugger.
Tree hugger. Enough to be called a Gnostic. You know, probably more so. So,
well, what I was going to ask you was this. What do you think about the whole idea of panspermia?
I don't know.
Well, it just seems to me when I was a kid growing up, that was like the reaction that most people said would you'd be crazy. That's the most crazy theory I've ever heard. But, you know,
well,
in reality,
you know,
finding amino acids on meteorites are saying now that they bombarded the planet. So how do we know?
We don't. And just because we can't understand it, we can see the progression up to a point, but we don't know how it got started. That's the stuff that bugs me. I get into this argument with skeptics all the time. You know, and I'm being logical. No, you're not. Logic is based upon a bunch of assumptions, things that you assume to be factual. And when you make a hypothesis, it is a logical leap from showing a relationship between all these facts. Now, what you wind up doing when you conduct an experiment is you do not prove the logic. You don't prove the hypothesis. You prove your facts.
Right. We got 2 minutes, less than 2 minutes.
Okay. This has gone by awful quick.
Yeah.
We had to pick this up again, Doug, somewhere, because
yeah,
I'm
definitely.
Sure this, you know. But hey. You know, this is the issue. I'm going to let you sum up. But I mean, you know, logic is a very, very difficult thing to apply properly, and you got to know when you're assuming and when you're right, and what is a fact and what isn't.
All right. So there was a question earlier on how does somebody learn more about cryptozoology. You want to tell us about Pangea Institute and all that?
Well, among other things, I teach cryptozoology, as you know, at Florida Keys Community College. I've got a class coming up starting May 18th.
Is that the online class?
Yes. You can contact them at 305-296-9081 starting on Monday the 13th because they're on spring break right now. And then you could sign up for the class. Pangea Institute, which is www.pangeainstitute.us, also offers classes that I teach periodically. So you can check the website for when we're going to announce a new one. You can write me at any time. There's some stuff in my blog on the Pangea website that deals with crypto education standards you might want to look at. And, you know, Doug, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Sounds good, and I encourage anybody who wants to learn about cryptozoology to go to Pangea Institute and take the class from Scott. I just finished it a few months back. It was a good class. It really helped me to broaden a lot of areas of my fields of interest, so appreciate that. Scott, thanks so much for coming on the show again. It's always a pleasure to have you, man. We'll have you back.
My
yeah,
pleasure.
Nice
anytime,
Scott.
You know, and drop me an email on this meeting on Saturday. I'll see if I can swing it to get down there.
Sounds great. And
that'd be excellent.
Next week, and speaking of that meeting, real quick, for those who joined us late, on this Saturday, the 11th of April, we're going to be having the Paranexus Monthly Forum. There's information on paranexus.org. If you're in the Florida area, we'd love to have you come and join us. A place to share a network. We're going to be talking about evidence review, psychic development. And we're also going to have a group discussion on proof of the paranormal. And Gregory Kent's also going to do a table tipping demonstration, which is always interesting. So come and join us if you can. Folks, we really appreciate you taking your time. Next week, Bob Otis on time travel. And with that, we've got to go. Have a great night. Good night. Thanks, Scott.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks
have a great weekend.
Take care,
thanks,
everybody.
Bye bye.
Good night.
In the night, in the shadows, in the sky, it's Paranexus Universe.